You can ask me any questions, or we can have a dialogue. We could just sit here quietly. Joseph? I think you better ask Geshe Taji. But I think, you know, like, I mean, they all have their, everything has its advantages and disadvantages. So when they come in young, oftentimes they still have, you know, a lot of, the world still is something they haven't experienced, a lot of things that you can't do in monastic life. I think when I came, because I was over 30, I had no more illusions about the world being something, you know, that I hadn't, that I had any real questions or doubts about. So I've never had problems with staying in the monastic life. You know, it's always, I've never wanted to leave it. But also, you have to, you know, being your karma ripens in as you get older. So many monks, you know, like Asian monks, do look pretty happy, but it doesn't mean that they're always that happy as they look. Yes. Well, like joy for me is a very natural relationship to the beautiful and the good that I experience. No, I mean, you know, you're living in, you know, so much of what one experiences in daily life is quite beautiful and good. And so I have a lot of joy. But the joy, say before, as I grew older, say in childhood, I had a joyful childhood, but as I became very self-conscious and obsessed with myself as a person, then that joyfulness seemed to go, and then there was this kind of, you know, worry, angst that seemed to be more my common experience than joy. And then through the meditation, now there's a lot of joy, because I like that poem by William Blake. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity sunrise. Now, I used to kind of like bind the joy, and then it, you know, it's like destroying your life. You're holding on to happiness, and then you, in the process of holding, you're destroying it all the time. Now you get cynical and bitter, you know, by doing that, because you're always grasping at it rather than whatever you grasp, then it changes. Well, joy, once you grasp it, it's no longer joyful, because that destroys the experience. The grasping does. They're like Blake's poem, "Kiss the Joy as It Flies," and that was quite an insight for me. Realize that you're not trying to hold on to it or seek it. You're not like trying to be happy anymore or find happiness or joy as experience. It just naturally is quite normal as a human to experience that. It's like, say, you know, just the, you know, you find just suddenly your mind just so joyful over just the things that, you know, the sun or the flowers and things, just simple things, you know, are surrounding us in daily life, bring us a lot of joy. But if we're caught up in worry and anxiety and self-disparagement, then even though it's still around us, we don't notice it. It doesn't resonate. Or if we do, we're trying to, we make problems about it, and then it, then we experience despair. That's the way it is. Well, you know, you could say somebody created it, or you don't know why. You don't know how it all came about, but the fact that it's here, you know, and that this is what it does, you know, you're mindful, then you can be aware of it. You know, you're aware of the beauty without trying to grasp it. And so then it, you know, then it changes, like say the clouds come and the flowers fade and that, but you don't feel you appreciate more the cycle than the peak moments. Where before, say, before I would always be aiming to live at the peaks of life, the peak moments, the kind of the best. And so the aim, say the intention, was always to get to the peak, to the, have the peak moment, peak experiences. And then when you did, you'd reach those, you'd have those, and then it couldn't sustain it. A peak moment is not a sustainable thing. So it, you know, you're always feeling this sense of loss again. So you get what you want, you know, and you've achieved it, you've reached the top, and then there's something disappointing in it, because your whole experience has been trying to reach that, and so when you reach it, you can't even enjoy it. The peak moment can't be really enjoyed. Because then the mind goes on, you know, then it's looking for something else. But with mindfulness, then you stop operating out of that kind of compulsion, always seeking the peaks of life, to being with the flow of experience. So even the unpleasant things of life are endurable and bearable. And a lot of things in life that before you dismissed, you find are quite beautiful. I mean, like, for example, when I first came to live in the UK in 77, I'd always liked living in sunny climates. And so, as soon as I was able to, I moved to California to live in the sunny California. And then I lived in Hawaii, and I lived in Borneo, and I lived in Thailand, and in India, and I'd always be seeking these sunny climates, and then I found myself in England. and at first I arrived in May of 1977, and it was a really cold and bleak May. And I felt cold all the time. And physically, I quite liked it, because my constitution thrives in this kind of climate, where I was obviously, you know, in the tropics, I wasn't physically very well. But I did find, like, gray weather, rain and cold would create negative states for me. I'd start complaining about it and thinking in negative ways. And just trying to seek warmth all the time. But then I contemplated what I was doing. So I started opening up to bleakness and cold and things like this. And suddenly I found a different way of looking at it. And I found all those things that I kind of complained about or dismissed were quite peaceful. and like the English winters here in Amaravati, you know, it gets very bleak up here, but to me that is very peaceful because my mind is in the bleakness, the grayness, the lack of this kind of stimulating beauty of spring and summer. It's the mind, if you're not making you know, negative thoughts about it, it's very conducive towards tranquility and calm. So I could go out and just walk out in the fields in the winter time and just letting my mind be with the subdued quality, the calm, the silence of the winter time, and feel, you know, it enhances, it helps the mind. Where if I start complaining, then I'm creating a problem about it. And if I don't do that, then the actual experience is, I've discovered the peacefulness of things like cold, bleakness, grayness, subdued colors. You look at the trunks of the trees, all the leaves have gone, and then you look at the trunks of the trees and the colors are there, but they're all subdued and quiet, not saying, you know, not loud and stimulating. And then you look at those kind of subdued colors on the trees, you know, and they're quite beautiful in themselves. But it's easy to ignore them because they're not like vibrant red or bilious pink or anything. And you know, my life before would just have ignored that and said, I don't like wintertime, and just dismissed wintertime. But in this openness of the mind, then you're also expanding. So your experience of life isn't always held within a few narrow perceptual expressions, but it seems to go in towards infinity and unlimited immeasurableness. Yes. Also, yes, it's like doing good things and without any selfish desire for anything in return is joy. And you find like joyful people are, love to, they serve, they help, but it's not in order to gain. So you take the joy out of doing good works if you want something back. And I've noticed, you know, like people will... I met some people who've lived very good lives. And, you know, they said, you know, I've given lots of money to the church, I've devoted hours of my life to helping the disabled. I've done this for this person, done that, but taken care of my mother, my father, my grandmother. I helped the whales and the sharks, and I've done everything for my children and sacrificed myself so that my children would have all the things I didn't have. And look at me now, you know, just left alone, out in the cold, nobody loves me. And so, you know, you think, you know, then your mind realizes that there's a demand for some gratitude or something in return in that statement. You know, so that now that person just thinks, I've done all this and I should be rewarded for it, and I'm not being rewarded. So it's, you know, to kind of set yourself up for misery. But if you, you know, I find if I do good things and I expect, and I even want somebody to say thank you, that destroys something, you know. because you're, if they don't say thank you, then you feel, you feel like you've not been given your proper due. Where the actual, when you investigate, just selfless giving is joyful in itself. It's its own reward. It's not, nobody need reward you, because just doing it is its own, it's immediate, and it's so you find joyful people are those that just kind of have that immediacy and joy, that, because they find the joy in the act itself rather than doing the act in order to be rewarded with happiness. Yes? Well, that is more, you have to, that's intuitive also, to, you know, you have to know yourself what, you know, there's so many different factors affecting every moment, really. But this is where you have to, you know, if you like with meditation, you're getting to know yourself, and you learn through trial and error. You know, even with mindfulness, you're still learning through. Not that you do everything right because you're mindful, but you're willing to learn from what you do. And sometimes you do it wrong, and then you learn that that's not probably the best way to do it, so you can change. But also, just I think one, you know, I feel very much that this intuitive awareness, people don't trust it. You know, many of us, I can see in myself a kind of longing for an external force to direct me, because you know, on the personal level, there's too much doubt about myself as a person to think that I should know, I can really know clearly what's the best thing for me to do. So I would find, you know, like I want to find, you know, somebody, an authority or a teacher or a guide or a guru, somebody out there, or God, or some, you know, who could, you know, confirm this, you do this, and then you do that, and then you're on the right track. And I could see, and Lung Po Cha was brilliant with this, because, you know, I lived with him for 10 years, and I found, no, I kept wanting him to kind of say, oh, now, Sumato, you have, you've reached this stage, and, you know, wanting him all the time to get confirmation that I'm doing everything all right, and that I'm now, you know, doing this, and then the next, and wanting direction, wanting confirmation. And he would never do that. And every time, he never confirm anything, you know. He'd keep laughing at me every time I'd kind of try to get some kind of confirmation, and he would kind of sometimes make fun of me. So I began to realize, you know, that he was, you know, what he was actually saying is, how do you expect me to know? You're the one that can know. You're the one that is experiencing things. And so he kept always kind of forcing me to take responsibility for my life and figure it out for myself, rather than getting hooked onto him and then him kind of telling me what to do next. And because of that, I developed a kind of confidence in myself, because I realized in some ways he trusted me more than I did. And that was very, you know, it was very inspiring to me to realize that, and I really contemplated that he actually had more confidence and trust in me than I actually had myself. And so and I thought, well, you know, that helps that he has that trust. And that's the kind of confirmation I needed, really. So it isn't that I've done everything after that in the right way or haven't made any mistakes, but I do try to learn. I don't always make the best decisions or right decisions on every issue, but I'm willing to learn from it, even from the mistakes. But this intuitive awareness is something I now trust a lot, because I really see it's what I can trust, was a real refuge. It's not something dependent on conditions being any certain way. It doesn't mean that life has to be, you know, everything going well, or everybody in harmony, or I'm feeling good, or whatever. It's something I can, that works no matter what, even if I'm sick and everything's falling apart. It's the intuition still is something that I can trust, in which I can, you know, not make a problem about the things that are happening. Give me perspective. Allows me to get perspective and develop virtues like patience with things that I'm usually impatient with, or gives me a more expansive mind, in a mind that used to be very fixed and could only accept this much. You know, it had to be like this or I couldn't accept it. And then with the intuitive awareness, is like it's opening out like that, almost to where there's no boundaries. You feel this expansiveness rather than narrowing feeling with my mind. Yes? Well, that's where, you know, if you want it to disappear, then it, that's where your attitude is one of if it stays forever, that's okay. It's not like, I'll accept you if you'll go away, but it but also, like, emotions are, I find, you know, there's so many, like, emotions that I've dismissed, like, say, stupidity, dullness, childishness, you know, like, immature feelings and feelings of, sulking and things that are very childish emotions, and when you grow up, you still have those emotions, but you kind of hide them, dismiss them. Then because you think, well, you know, you don't, even though you're feeling this emotion, you think you have disgust for it, and you think it's weak and bad, and you want to get rid of it, and you don't want anyone to know that you're feeling like this. What's a big man like you sulking for? You think of, I don't sulk. But sometimes that emotion, it's not an emotion that I haven't experienced in my adult life. And I try to hide it. Usually I try to, something, I would reject. And then in the meditation, a lot of these rejected emotions started coming. As I became more confident in how to deal with emotional experience, then I began to let them in. And I could see, because my father, he died at 90, and he wasn't a reflective person at all. He was, his mind, it wasn't kind of into contemplation or accessing his emotions in any way. So he, the last 10 years of his life, he went through the whole range of the most childish emotions. To see a man, who was your father, who'd been a very confident, kind of successful man in, being in control and in charge and being the I'll take care of you, and I can take care of myself kind of man. And then suddenly, you know, crying all the time, sulking when he couldn't get his way, throwing little tantrums and feeling sorry for himself. And just all the time, just these very childish emotions surfacing in the last few years of his life. And I contemplated, realized that he'd never really, you know, those things had been kind of unresolved all his life. Then in the last stages of his life, where he lost control of the world, then he couldn't, you know, operate with the same delusions he had before. Suddenly all this stuff comes up. So then I determined I was going to try to work this out before I get to 80. Because I realized that, you know, how the opportunity that I have that my father didn't have. You know, I've had many more, you know, opportunities for this kind of development. He never had much of an opportunity for his generation, you know, towards, say, psychology or towards getting to know yourself. It was all, you know, this is what a man is and you act like this, and this is what a woman is and she should be like that, and the mother's like this and the father's like that, and the son should be like this and the daughter should be like that. It's all neat package of roles that you act out in life, but you don't know how to deal with what you're actually feeling. And I realized that generation of Western people, you know, Western people, we did not have, say, any very much option or alternatives other than to go along with the system. Now it's all everything, you know. You can challenge every role, every convention in the system. And that also has its bad side, in the sense that people can just spend their lives being obsessed with their feelings, you know, just being totally indulgent in what I feel and what happened to me, and you know, endlessly complaining the fact that they didn't get enough love or they weren't, you know, the way people do is, you know, can be so obsessed with themselves that is the opposite extreme of the other. You know, it's just becoming too self-important. But in a religious path, they where your aim is this realizing the truth in a transcendent reality, then you can always, you know, you have perspective to deal with your personal conditioning and your emotions. So it's like I know now I can have these, I mean, I'm quite willing to have these childish, immature emotional experiences because I see it as my path, not to identify with it anymore, but to accept it and to let it resolve itself rather than me coming from the position of me trying to get rid of it. Because the refuge is in this awareness rather than in some sense of me trying to become this normal man, that this ideal, this model of what men should be. It doesn't ring true for me, but this refuge in transcendent awareness is something I trust implicitly now, because it does allow for one to work through one, what they say in Buddhist terms, one's karma. So these sulking feelings or the things of like being hurt, somebody said something that hurt me, and then you can think, I feel hurt. They shouldn't be talking like that to me. And I can accept those kind of feelings now, rather than wallowing in that feeling or feeling guilty about it. You know, it's like you have a vehicle now in which you can really work with your life in an honest and accurate way. And emotions are, I think for many of us, the greatest challenge. Because they're the most, embarrassing. Like I find so many of my emotions quite embarrassing. You know, I like to look dignified and like to give. And emotions are not always very dignified, are they? Yes? Bereavement. Now that's one of the emotions that I've really examined, because in the past decade, so many people close to me have died. So my parents, my teachers, friends, and that, and just in this past month, we've had series of deaths of people I know here, Buddhist people. But and so and death is a contemplation that is the Buddha used. There's just to contemplate that experience of when somebody dies, or even encourage looking at corpses, or going to places where they're like graveyards and places where people have died, or where they burn or bury people, because death is something that we haven't experienced yet, physical death. And so it leaves this state of, for me, it's like the mind goes into this state where it's quite empty, because I don't know what happens when you die, when you're dead, in terms of my own experience of it. And I've heard people tell, say what happens and all that, but we're talking now about direct awareness, direct knowing. So I know that I don't know, and that not knowing. Death is like the word itself leaves my mind in a kind of empty place. When somebody's dead, she's dead now. There's a kind of gap in my consciousness. It's like, that's how I can explain it. Like there's an empty place now, because I don't know what that is. And so we do try to make out that, like when my mother died, my mother was a Roman Catholic, so they had a Catholic funeral. And so I went to the Catholic funeral, and the priest said, "Now Helen Jackman is in heaven with the Lord," and she's and so it was very inspiring, actually, and it made you feel good, because that were all kind of nice images of my mother now released from an old body that was falling apart, and she's in a very happy place. She always wanted to be with the Lord anyway. And now she was, the priest was saying she was there. And it all made you feel good, not to deny that. But the fact was, I didn't know. I didn't know. What I had to admit was I didn't know that. I mean, I could believe or disbelieve it. So this is how in Buddhist meditation you're not denying those things or taking sides, but in fact you're admitting what you can actually, you're knowing what you can know and what you don't know. And that I find very peaceful, like the sense of loss of a loved one. is, you know, somebody that you love a lot, and then they're gone. That it feels like this, and so you know, it's a what you might call grief or sorrow at loss. But those are just words, and they're pointing to the actual emotion. So then I go, I drop the words and look at the actual feeling of loss, and it feels like this. And I find that I can accept that feeling as a feeling. It's not depressing, and it feels like, and if you want to call it something, you call it grief, but it's not. I don't even consider it suffering. It is like this, and it's a natural kind of emotion. But I'm not. But it becomes suffering when I make a problem about it. So I start thinking, oh, she's gone forever. And I start, you know, if I start thinking about it, then I can indulge in that feeling, or I can just say, well, that's life, stiff upper lip, gone, goodbye, get on with your life, and dismiss it. So, or that alone, I find that ability to admit and to hold that feeling and experience it completely allows that grief to resolve itself. You know, it's not. And you find that it leads towards a peacefulness of the mind rather than a fear or depression or negativity. So I mean, like, sometimes, like dealing with death, I don't find death depressing. I don't find, I mean, we've had several people die here at Amaravati, have come here intentionally to die at Amaravati. And every time, you know, it's not depressing. It's rather, in some ways, you'd say it's almost inspiring. So you change. And yet people who are afraid of death find it depressing. So they'll say, you know, they'll say, they just feel that somebody dying is just depressing, and they just, you know, can't cope with it, so they tend to run away. But if you're actually with it, and I've talked to other people who've said this, you know, the monks and nuns that have done this, they've you know, they find it calming, and even sometimes when somebody's dying very mindfully, and they're able to share their death with you, they're telling you what's happening, and you're able to kind of meditate together on it. It's quite joyful. Like when Amina died, that was quite a joyful experience. It wasn't depressing. I mean, one felt the sadness, and you weren't happy that she died, but the actual experience wasn't, because she died so well, it was quite a joyful experience. But then there is a sadness of that the natural sadness, but that's not depressing either. That's quite peaceful. And it's those things, that kind of pathos of life, where all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. That's a very sad reflection. You know, we chant this in the morning, we say, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And then, you know, in a worldly mind, that's, you know, that's rather sad thing to think. But yet it's true. We know that. And that's, and the sadness of knowing that who we love, it will die or will separate. But that sadness is not depressing either. And that sadness also encourages us to look more deeply into life than just try to get superficial thrills out of, you know, trying to be happy and turn on yourself to just very superficial ways of arousing some kind of happiness all the time. Because there's nothing more pathetic than a human being who's just lived solely to be happy all the time. Rather, it's very sad. Probably, but I haven't met any. And also, you know, like I experienced, like Ajahn Chah was, his approach to meditation was to see death in the present. So it's like the ending in death. Death is a very charged word, you know. It has a high impact on your consciousness. But say the ending of something is quite ordinary. We all know something's going to end. Say the end of something isn't such an impact. You know, it's not so strong. So in terms of, like, I would contemplate just the mental changes within me, the arising of an emotion and the end of it, or the beginning of a thought and the end of it. And so you're always in the examination of the Four Noble Truths, you're observing the ending of things in your mind. So in that, though that's actually a death, you know, what arises ceases, what begins ends. But it's not, but then the death of the body is, it would be the same thing really, but that is something we have to wait for the time for that to happen. But I do feel, you know, from extrapolating from the cessation of mental phenomena in my mind, that really the body is all that dies, you know. It's not like, you know, just like your personality comes and goes, is born and dies all the time throughout the day. One moment you're like this, you're this person, next moment you're another kind of person, changing, always born and dying, beginning and ending, according to emotional experience. When you take this refuge in this awareness, in the Buddha, knowing the Dhamma, then that is actually deathless. It's not personal anymore, and it's not something that is born and dies. It's not conditioned by the world or through ignorance. So it's you can see what the Buddha meant by the deathless truth or amata dhamma, because then your refuge is in the amata dhamma rather than in your emotional state or your memories or your physical body. You know, it's not what you are, not your refuge anymore, not a refuge. Like what this mindfulness, the path to the deathless, mindfulness or this intuitive awareness, or the ability to pay attention in the present, a simple act, this listening where the mind is opening, in a receptive state, that you can trust. You can't trust your emotions because they are, you know, they're conditioned by ignorance. But you can learn from your emotions that they are impermanent, they're not self. So that's where this mindfulness is willing to embrace what you're feeling without judging. No, like if you are having, you know, like bereavement, and then in that intuitive awareness, you're willing to let either crying or grief or feeling of loss or emotions that do arise, like, you know, like guilt or sorrow or whatever. You're not judging it anymore. You're not saying you shouldn't be feeling this or making any problem about it, but you're totally willing to experience those emotional states. Then you're actually letting that grief go, and you're resolving it. So it's not like pressing anymore. You're not dismissing, and you're not caught in an identity with it, as you know, where you would indulge in it. You're actually learning from it. So in that case, then you feel a sense of relief and bliss when you can let go of grief like that, which isn't making it go, but accepting it, and even the kind of emotions that are triggered off from that feeling itself, you accept the whole lot, and then you can it will naturally cease, and then you're not holding anything back, and that your mind is then prepared to deal with life as you have to experience it, rather than being caught in anxiety, fears, and unresolved emotional blockages. Then life also has it, you know, so many little hooks on it that you have to, you know, being mindful is once you're heedless, then you know you're easily caught on these hooks, and so you know, like being a senior monk here, being the spiritual director of this monastery and all that, these kind of worldly positions, they bring up such ideas as being responsible, responsibility. I am responsible for this, and that seems like a good quality to be. You know, they praise people. You know, he's a very responsible spiritual director. It's very, you know, or you know, they're very, I'm very high-minded identities that are praised by the world. But once then you can see the suffering that comes from that. On a personal level, when I start feeling I'm responsible, then I feel burdened by all this immediately. I start worrying about it. I'm responsible for Amaravati, and then suddenly something goes wrong. I'm responsible. This monk disrobes. I'm responsible for that. This nun has a nervous breakdown. I'm responsible for that. I mean, you're really setting yourself up. It's really, you know, you've set yourself up. You think, I don't want to be responsible. I'm going to leave. I'm going to become a hermit. I'm going to go off to my cave. I don't want to be responsible for any nuns or monks or anyone else, you know, if they're going to do things like that. And so it's a burden. But if you... But then, with awareness, you can see that you don't identify with that, and I can really be responsible if I'm not attached to the idea of it. It's not that I'm irresponsible, but then responsibility is coming from wisdom rather than from an idea that I am responsible for all this. Because once you operate on that level of I am responsible, then It does. It becomes, you know, I can see why people don't want to be the spiritual director of Amaravati. Why they don't want to become abbot of this monastery. Why they don't want to be the senior nun. Why they don't want to be the this and that. Because, you know, if you're responsible for this, that means you get blamed too when it all goes, when it doesn't work. Or when it goes wrong, and nobody wants to be blamed, and it's all fraught with personal feelings of, you know, your personal worth. But and so it leads to a lot of anguish and bitterness and disillusionment. If you're even doing the most noble acts from this basic ignorance of I am responsible for this, or this is mine. But in investigating that whole feeling, like I began to observe that. Like I just say to myself, "You're responsible for Amaravati." Then I'd kind of watch the feeling of that. You know, what's it like to be this person who's responsible for this place? I could see just that whole thing together, me and Amaravati and that identity as being suffering. It frightens me. It seems too much. It seems too many factors I can't control. It's too big. There's too many people. Too many strong personalities. There's too many unknown factors. I can't do it. So then you think, I want a nice little monastery where I can control. It's a nice little cottage in the country with a couple of monks that I get on with that agree with me. No, that's not it either, because when that happens also there's a lot of suffering. The suffering isn't due to the size of the people, but your attitude, your ignorance around it. So then, having seen observed the suffering that comes from me being responsible, then I stop that. I don't have to create that image anymore. And trusting in this awareness, I find that I am much more capable of doing what needs to be done here without making it into a personal burden. So it's quite joyful. I feel quite a lot of joy here because it isn't personal. It's not me trying to do everything right and make everything right and then feeling when people start complaining that I'm responsible. But it's just the joy of making such an opportunity available to people and that people are interested and that not to demand that they, you know, not to, you know, the personal approach always is a kind of demand that, you know, I've done this, you should do that. I'm responsible and you should respect that I am responsible and therefore conduct yourself in a way that doesn't make me feel disappointed or disillusioned. I think that is emotional blackmail, isn't it? So just by investigating it, you know, you see the suffering of even being a good person doing good things. It's tremendous, you know. You meet so many good people who have been so disappointed and disillusioned by their very good intentions and good acts because of the basic illusion around being a person that's doing good acts or doing good things and is responsible for it. So I think That's enough for this afternoon.